Very good. We have a very small audience today, but maybe the others are still stuck with after the previous class or something. We'll see. We talked about scientific creativity, or creativity in general. The important thing that I said was that creativity is something that you can develop in yourself. You can, no matter how creative you are now, you can make it better. You can be more creative. And creativity is very, very important. So a few slides just to remind you what we talked about. Remember the trick with the dots? This was a trick that I learned from Randy Pausch. The idea was that a little bit of indoctrination, asking you to look at the green dots, made you disregard the yellow dots, which are much, much bigger. Of course, it's a trick. You may be a little upset about this, but the idea, I think, is quite clear. You were biased by what I told you. You can actually bias people very easily. When I studied a branch of cognitive psychology known as behavioral decision theory, I learned a lot of tricks how you can actually influence people, how circumstances or framing of a problem can influence people's behavior. Those tricks are probably first discovered by advertisers, people who want to sell you something, or politicians who want to influence the public. In any case, we are very influenceable. We can be influenced very, very easily. For example, suppose we are about to vote on one of the two candidates. Did you know that if I say something good about one of the candidates right before the voting, that will influence the result of the voting? Incredible that we are so easy to influence. In any case, our past experience and education can also influence us and make us possibly less creative. Probably it's in the negative side, the less creative, because prior experiences and prior education change the way we look at the world. There are also good things about prior experiences and education, but in general, there can be also negative influences. So there was motivation on why creativity is important. The idea here is that as a scientist, you need to invent problems. You need to find good questions to ask. And that is something that nobody will really tell you how to do. How to solve problems you've been learning all your life, but how to find problems. In every class that you've taken in school or at university, they gave you problems to solve. But very rarely they were teaching you how to find problems, good problems to look at. And a scientist has to do that. And that requires creativity. Nice quotes from Einstein, definition of creativity, then one of the definitions. Every good, important topic will have many definitions. Theories of creativity, depending on who you are, you look differently at the world. And depending on the branch of typically psychology, people have different definitions. Psychoanalytic, behaviorist, cognitive, and I would say social psychology or clinical psychology will look at motivation. Then we looked at, this was important, the four phases of a creative process. Preparation, where you want to understand the problem and you want to assess your resources, you want to see if you have everything that you need before you even proceed. The second phase is incubation. That ideally should be the longest phase because this is the time where you start thinking about the problem, how to solve it. Most of you in your doctoral studies are probably, you hopefully have this phase behind you. You know what you are working on. You've read enough to understand the problem, the context, the literature, etc. Now you are trying to find a good solution. That's the incubation phase. Incubation should be really going into different directions, focusing on low probability, high payoff alternatives, just trying to find a solution. And then this is followed by illumination. That's like, wow, I have it. I found the solution. Usually a very short phase. Suddenly everything falls into place. It's like a puzzle. You think you have a solution. The last phase, verification, where you have to be very sober, very logical to check if the solution really fulfills your needs. You can be wrong in illumination, but in verification you will check whether you were right or wrong. The next important thing, so the phases is an important thing, realizing about how the creative process goes. Blocks are also very important because we can systematically address them. These are the things that are disturbing us in becoming creative. Perceptual, we look and see the problem wrongly. Emotional, uncomfortable emotions influence our creativity. Cultural blocks, so things, the culture that we were brought in may disturb us in finding a solution. And environmental blocks. And then we talked a little about each of these. Perceptual blocks, it's the way that we look at the problem that disturbs us. There was an example with the monk. This also is, I think, a perceptual problem. Our experience suggests that we open one link at each of the segments, while the solution is actually opening three links in one of the four. It's just a different way of looking at the problem. And this was also a perceptual problem. Remember, the first thing that we think about after years of schooling is physics, kinematics, the distance, time, speed, etc. Well, the solution is actually much, much simpler. It requires you to look at it differently. Two monks, we put them together and there exists a place where they will meet. I promise you a solution to this. It will be there in a moment. This is a typical example of a block that in which we put on ourselves unnecessary constraints. Something that you should eliminate in the very first phase when you try to understand the problem. Emotional blocks, fear of taking a risk. Very often we are afraid of taking a risk. My wife and I have traveled a lot in Spanish-speaking countries. My wife took a couple of years of Spanish, so she knows the grammar reasonably. I've never done it. I just learned whatever I heard, maybe a little bit of reading, but just heard. I'm the one who starts speaking, usually. And then when I get into trouble, I need to use some complicated tense. I said, well, you know, my wife will explain you further what I mean. In learning a language, the courage is very important, courage to speak. She's actually much better than I in Spanish, but I'm usually the one who starts speaking. It has helped me a lot with learning languages. So fear of taking a risk, it's a common thing among us. We are just afraid of saying something stupid and then we don't say anything, or doing something stupid. Status quo, we are biased towards it. Reality versus fantasy, we as children we fantasize, but as adults we are repressing those feelings of fantasizing. We no longer invent things that are not there. It's okay, I mean, we are serious, but sometimes it disturbs us in seeing a solution, in solving a problem. Judgment and criticism, we can be judgmental towards ourselves. We are unsure about this. I may have mentioned to you the difference, statistical, typical difference between men and women, gentlemen and ladies. I spoke about this in the context of reviews. You get a review that is critical, the first reaction of a man is, what's wrong with him? He doesn't understand it, right? Something wrong with the reviewer. Very often, ladies think, oh boy, what is wrong with myself? Yes, what did I do wrong? And why am I telling that? Of course, it's not individual differences may be bigger than differences between sexes. Of course, nothing wrong with the lady who is sure of herself, nothing wrong with the gentleman who is unsure. My advice is for gentlemen, do help your female colleagues in becoming more daring, more believing in her, in themselves, because women tend to be more less believing in themselves. So they are more judgmental. Something, you know, I should do something better, or maybe I did something wrong. Men are more daring and sometimes too sure of themselves. So ladies, influence your colleagues, male colleagues who are too sure of themselves too. Don't leave them too bold. But you should actually have a sound amount of boldness, of courage. You should not judge yourself too early. Inability to incubate. That's important. And sometimes what people do is they don't take enough time. You know the expression, let me sleep over it. What do we say in Polish? I forgot. Pardon? Yes, przespać się nad jakimś problemem, prawda? That's a very important thing. Don't try to shorten that incubation period. You need to take time. Very often I advise people to start early. Don't start with your important project, with your paper, too close to the deadline. Start early so that you have the time to just sleep over it. Take a break. Come back to it later. Taking a break allows you to somehow, there are different explanations of that process of incubation, but usually it helps you. So start early. When you do, for example, programming, computer programming, I always tell people start early because sometimes you get stuck. You don't know what is happening, the program doesn't work, and you spend half an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours on it, you cannot find the problem. There's a good chance that 10 hours will not help you either. What you need to do is you need to sleep, take a break, come back to it. Or ask a colleague, can you look at it? And then when you explain your colleague what the program is doing, very often you'll find, oh, wow, how stupid of me. Here is the problem. You find it yourself. In any case, take a break, ask for help. And for that, you need to start early. The same with all kinds of creative behavior. Don't start too late. Take your time. You can do other things. Take a break from the problem. Come back to it when you are rested. Cultural blocks, and here is where we stopped. Remember the problem. Many, many things available, but they are all essentially to make the riddle more difficult. I told you this Jewish riddle that apparently I heard parents are telling the children. In fact, I verified with a couple of my Jewish colleagues. Yes, they have heard it from the parents. The same here, many, many things, tools, wires, and ropes. The only thing you can, the solution is that requires you to urinate inside. Then there's a liquid which will push out the ball. That sounds a little gory and not very nice. It's an example of a cultural taboo. In our culture, we don't do that typically. But if your life depends on it, I gave you an example from that movie, We Were Soldiers, urinating on the mortars, mortar guns, actually saved their lives because they cooled them down and they were able to shoot, keep shooting. So it's just an example of cultural block, cultural taboo. Some cultures don't, or organizations don't, encourage humor, playfulness, fantasy, and reflection. We are dealing with far too serious problems to be joking here. And sometimes humor and fantasy, reflection, helps us with finding a solution. Examples of such cultures are maybe some organizations, like military organizations, maybe religious organizations. You are in the company of the bishop, priests, you know, it's not in a good taste to actually make fun or make jokes about things. So some environments are not very, some cultures are not encouraging that. Reason and logic. Here, what I think about is there is this, again, I tell usually about the two main differences between sexes, male and females, males and females. Here is very often what happens in very close relationships, like marriages. There's a quarrel, right? You don't quarrel with acquaintances and just friends. You quarrel between the people who know each other very well. So in a marriage, you sometimes quarrel. That's normal. So now you quarrel, and very often what happens is the man says to the woman, look, if A then B, right? Yes. If B then C, yes? Yes. Then if A then C, yes? No. The man gets very frustrated. She doesn't use completely logic, right? That doesn't make sense what she's saying. Very often what happens in this kind of situations, I found it over time, is that men are very, very logical, very, you know, try to make it systematic and logical, but they very often solve a wrong problem. Women have a much better kind of intuition, the sense of smell, to get to the core of the problem. So that's what makes them sometimes seem to be illogical, because they see the problem better. Maybe they cannot verbalize it right away, but they see it. So the advice, again, in this context to men, listen to your female partner, to your wife. Listen carefully, because she may be seeing the problem much better than you do. Of course, ladies, try to be logical too, because otherwise it's frustrating to the guy, so try to verbalize it. But it's an example that I noticed in kind of daily things. What we are generally, as especially you who are engineers, we are educated to use logic and reason, and sometimes you have to take a distance from it sometimes. Emotions, intuitions, feelings, they are also important tools that we have, and we kill them. Artistic thinking skills. As children, we are encouraged to draw, to sing, to dance, etc. As adults, we don't do that too often, do we? How many of you like dancing or dance regularly? Who likes dancing? Well, come, oh, very good. Typically, when I ask this question, a majority of women say, well, we like dancing. When I ask men, there may be one or two who like dancing. We'll come back to that maybe in the context of time management. It's one of very nice things to relax, to de-stress yourself. I learned dancing when I was 50. And if I knew how much women like dancing, my wife loves dancing, I would have learned when I was 15. But it took me time to appreciate it. I really learned at the age of around 50. I like dancing. I tell my wife I'm doing it for her, but actually I like it too. It's nice. These things are also killed in us in adults, but we should use them also. Tradition and change is another cultural block, and that depends on the society. In the British society, for example, is known for being very proud of their tradition. I had a colleague when I was in the Netherlands, a Dutch woman who spent a few months, she was a nurse, in a hospital in London. And of course, here she is, a young woman from the Netherlands, very organized society. Within a few weeks, she knew how to do things better in the hospital. So she went to the director and said, well, we can do this and that better. You know, she tried to be helpful. And the director looked at her and said, this is the way we've been doing it for the last 400 years. Why do you think we should be changing it? It was kind of funny. Tradition. We are all biased towards tradition. There is a saying in Polish, prowizorka żyje najdłużej. There's a saying also in English, similar. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. if it's not broken, don't fix it. It's working, right? So it expresses our bias towards the tradition and unwillingness to change things. Environmental blocks, I think, is the last one. It is the work environment that may affect creativity. It can be non-supportive, criticizing, or judging. There is a concept in Polish, we say a toxic family, toxic work environment. I think that is the term that comes to my mind in this context. In some environments, we don't feel well. You may have memories from your childhood, maybe one of your parents was too critical. When the parents are too critical, then children feel, they don't feel encouraged to do things that are creative because the environment is critical, too critical. Sometimes there is red tape, there is bureaucracy, things that that generally don't tolerate new ideas. Whenever I try to fight with bureaucracy, with too many signatures, too many stamps, too many papers, there's always a lot of resistance that I encounter, and that's everywhere. Everywhere in the world, I see that. It's not only a Polish thing. Even though I have definitely noticed a lot of paperwork, unnecessary signatures, etc. In our university. Autocratic bosses. So the managers who are maybe creative themselves, but they are creating an atmosphere where people don't feel welcome in bringing up ideas. Some organizations are hierarchical, bureaucratic, and they suppress creativity. That's apparently a picture from Chinese army. You see, that's the stereotype of army environments. You have to be just one of the many number. Which is a very interesting stereotype, but that is, I think, wrong. I was several times in company of very high-ranked military officers, generals, admirals, just a few times. It was like maybe 3-4 times I was in a meeting with those very high-ranked people. That was in U.S., it wasn't in Poland. And the surprising thing, the thing that really surprised me when I talked with them, they were incredibly, incredibly gentle, polite, and nice people. My stereotype was that a general would come in and said, "You sit straight, you go there, etc." You know, just used to giving orders, not tolerating anything that departs from the order. And those people were so nice. And it was really an observation I made in several places. A general would come to a meeting. I was a guest there. I had a short presentation. He would come into the room, come to the highest ranked officer, and then he would say hello, gave him a hand, just, you know, so nice, you know, smiling, and then he would sit there unobtrusively, so nice. And I spoke to a colleague of mine, a female colleague whose father was also a high ranked officer. And she said that one of the reasons for that may be that you cannot go up in the hierarchy without help of other people, of your people who are around you, with your colleagues. If you don't have good social skills, you will never advance, essentially. That's the mechanism that makes them, the people on the top, very, very nice. I guess it doesn't work for dictatorships and generally unhealthy societies, but in a normal, healthy society where your merit makes you grow, I think this is an important mechanism. So the stereotype of high-ranked officers being dictators, I don't think it's completely true. My experiences are very, very different. They are strong internally. When the time comes, when they have to make a decision, they will make decisions quickly. They will not be frightened. They will be really very strong. When needed, but otherwise they are really, in my experience, very nice people. Finally, in this kind of the theoretical overview of what you can do, the reason why we talked about the blocks is that you want to consciously eliminate them in your thinking. Go in an environment that's nice, that is supportive. When you are a boss, create a supportive environment. Don't let people judge too quickly. If you have somebody who is judging too quickly, talk to him or her on the side. Maybe you can withhold yourself a little bit from that. Yourself as a boss, don't be autocratic. And there will be a few other tricks here. This thing, these are just the things that you can do to enhance creativity. Assumption breaking. So when you are in this initial phase, when you define the problem, I forgot what the phase was called, try to think whether all the assumptions you are making are unnecessary there. Here is where this, here is the solution of the nine dots problem. So you can really do it with four lines. Why is it difficult? It is difficult because the lines suddenly go outside of the square that is determined by the nine dots. That's why we don't see it. But nobody told us that the lines have to be within the square. Right? Great example of assumption that we put on ourselves in our mind, and that disturbs us in finding the solution. You can, of course, if you treat those dots as circles, and you make those lines cross far from that square, you can perhaps do it with three lines. Nobody told us that the lines have to go through the center of those dots, right? Again, I'm stretching the problem here. The solution on the left will work when you have dots, really points. But if they are small circles, you can do it this, or you can also do it with one line. Nobody told us anything about the thickness of the line. So, you know, try to be like this. Of course, I think that this is the smartest solution for this problem, but you see how assumptions can be broken. You can take away the assumptions and then you find the solutions. They talk about this, it's actually not the glass ceiling that they talk about for women, that women encounter the glass ceiling. This is more like a box, thinking inside the box or outside the box. They say it in English, think outside of the box, which says essentially don't feel restricted. Don't think in using stereotypes, just, you know, break all the assumptions, look for solutions outside. Very often we put that box around ourselves unnecessarily. Here is another technique that was postulated in the context of creativity, process analysis. When I think about this, here is a puzzle. There are 10 male senators with cylinders. Cylindri, but it's in English it would be called hats, I guess. Just hats. There's maybe another name for that. They get all of them taken down and they are on the ground, and somebody picks up those hats and gives each of the senators a hat. What is the probability that exactly nine senators will get their own hats? It's a little bit of a tricky question. The solution is the probability will be zero, because when nine of them have their own hats, the tenth has to have his own hats too. Had two, right? There's no other possibility. But you find the solution only by imagining those hats. This idea is similar to what is happening in police work. Those of you who have seen any police suspense movie know the idea of of recreating what happened. In Polish, I think they say wizja lokalna. I forgot the term in English, but the idea is that if you have a suspect or if you have witnesses to a crime scene, you bring them to that crime scene and ask, where exactly did you stand? Well, I was standing here, right? And then, and what did you do? What did you see? So in this environment, the real environment, you can see whether it's possible that they are telling the truth or not. Because you see now, from this position, you couldn't see that, right? Or you could see this. And this is very similar. Just think about how things are happening. And that helps a lot in finding the solution. This idea is it's called fluent and flexible thinking, because the problem of creativity is so important. You will find those things in the literature, how people advise to behave, to become more creative. So fluent and flexible thinking is pretty much brainstorming. I think it's brainstorming, although not exactly. You try to essentially be fluent, come up with many ideas quickly, and flexible in the sense of looking at in the depth, breadth, looking at many possible ideas and directions. The example that was given, I tried once playing that. For example, I'm marketing ideas for a brickyard owner who has financial difficulties, finds it difficult to sell bricks, and the question is, what can we do? And then, you know, brainstorming with ideas, what can we do with bricks? You think about the weight, the shape of the brick, what can you do? You can build houses, of course, but maybe you can make bookshelves, right? Put bricks and then put wooden boards in between them. Do things like this. We'll come back to a similar idea known as brainstorming, which can be used. This idea is similar to pre-printed notebooks, shopping lists. I don't know if you've ever seen them. They print them, you know, small format, and there is pre-printed eggs, milk, bread, vegetables, fruits, etc. So the idea is, when you take a notebook like this, you go and in a supermarket you read that list and say, oh yeah, eggs, I need to buy eggs too, and milk. So here the idea checklists are also pre-printed, invented by somebody, questions and ways that tell you how to think about a problem, solving a problem. The kind of general lists that they have come up with. Brainstorming is an idea that originated in US, I think, in 1960s or so, 50s, 60s, long ago. The idea here is that when you have a problem, let's say in an organization, in a company, you meet in a room, usually a small group of people, around 10 or so. Not too many, because it becomes a little bit disorderly. You have a whiteboard or blackboard or maybe a projection screen, and people, and there are very strict rules in brainstorming session. No evaluation is possible, so we have to come up with ideas. So suppose that you say, okay, we should do this. Some people may find it a silly idea, but they have to keep their mouth shut. We put that idea on the board, maybe we type it, you can see it on the screen. The only thing that is permitted is improving on an idea. So then somebody else says, well, I like the idea, but maybe it's better to do it slightly differently. So you improve on ideas, but you may not criticize them. Because there is no criticism, people get very quickly they get the courage to speak up. I've been to sessions like this. It is really working, really working. And people are asked to think about the wildest ideas. So even if they are silly, you can even joke, you bring up ideas. You put them on the board, and then you improve on them. When an idea is superior, you can take the original idea down, you come up with new ideas. In the beginning, typically there is, the beginning is a little bit difficult, but then things start getting more interesting, and you see interesting, better solutions. And enthusiasm of a few people is contagious. Zakaźne. Zależne. contagious. In the beginning, usually there are simple solutions, but then new concepts emerge. Very interesting idea, small groups of people, no criticism, that's the important thing. A couple of examples of work. I'm going to make it brief. I'm not going to spend a long time on it, but here's an idea that I noticed. This was at Carnegie Mellon, where I was working on my PhD. I was at that time meeting with Herb Simon regularly, once a week, and he was just two floors higher in the psychology department. I usually came a few minutes beforehand, and before the meeting I usually wanted to go to the toilet to make sure that nothing disturbs my thinking during the meeting. I wanted to be very well prepared. And I noticed in the toilets a very interesting idea, which I liked. Inside the cabins there were small blackboards and chalk. You could write on them. You know, I thought, well, what a nice idea. People will not write on the walls. They can write on the board if they come there. And there was also another thing I noticed. Herb Simon had a beeper at that time. I don't know if you know what beepers are. Pagers. When somebody wanted to contact somebody, would send a message on a pager. The pager would beep. Beep, beep, beep. And then there was a place for a very short message or a phone number that they can call. Very often physicians, doctors wore them, also drug dealers wore them at that time. Herb Simon had a beeper like this, and then during a meeting it beeped, and he said, well, you know, I'm in a study, I'm supposed to tell what I'm doing at the moment. So he had a recording device. He pressed it on and said, well, I'm sitting with a student and discussing the problem of that and that, whatever. And then I was also monitoring the bulletin board of the psychology department, comparable to today's Facebook page. Essentially, emails posted there. Whenever there was an interesting talk, I could know about this and go there. In any case, one day there was an announcement from another student of Herb Simon in psychology, Craig Kaplan, that sounded like this. If you want to know why there were the true reason for the chalkboards in the toilets and why the professors in the psychology department were walking with pagers, come to my defense. And then, of course, there was a title of the PhD dissertation and abstract. The dissertation focused on the process of incubation. That's why I want to tell you a little bit about this. The process of incubation is essentially, remember this incubation phase. You have a problem, you kind of walk around, sleep and do things, think, try to find a solution. And probably most of us have the experience that sometimes we wake up and then we have a solution. Suddenly. We have thought about this for a few days and then suddenly the solution comes to us when we wake up or when we do something. So he wanted to study why that happens. What is the reason? What is the mechanism why this happens? And that was the dissertation. Here were the goals. This is boring, so I'm going to just tell you the essential things. Here were the goals, the question. Why does putting a problem aside really help? And why? What is the mechanism? And there are many theories, so he listed the different ways of explaining why that happens that are in the psychology literature. Unconscious work, of course, this is the, like, psychoanalysis, Freud psychoanalysis. There are unconscious processes working in our brain, and while we are vacuum cleaning or riding a bicycle, taking shower, those processes are working on it, and at some point they knock, we have a solution for you, and then you say, oh, wow, I have a solution. Conscious work that is later forgotten. So we essentially, when we do things, take shower, walk, we think about the problem, but then we forget that we thought about this. And when the solution comes, we think, oh boy, it came out of nowhere. That's why the beepers, remember here, the beepers that were probing the professors to say what they were doing. recovery from fatigue that has to do with conceptualizing how we solve problems, the early AI, the symbolic AI, focused on the intelligence as a problem of searching in a solution tree. So you walk through the tree, and then you take a break, and recovery from fatigue. Of course, you get tired. You come back next. You are fresher, and then you can find the solution easier. Forgetting is with the tree. You visited many branches of that search tree, and you forgot where you were, but you kind of feel that direction wasn't very good. So essentially, by forgetting, we are doing the search better next time. Priming is one of the things that he studied. The idea of priming is that you are essentially led to the solution by things that you don't even notice. I'll tell more about this. Maturation is as time passes, we are essentially better. We've learned something, so we are more likely to find the solution. Statistical regression, that's a process that that happens. I'm not going to get into explaining what it exactly is, although maybe we should. You are tall, quite tall for a lady. Yes. How tall are you?
173
centimeters. Oh, not very tall. Why? Let's look at
guys.
Who is very tall?
Who's very tall? 184.
184 is not little. Do you have a brother?
No. Sister.
Darn. Sister. I bet you are taller than your father.
Yes.
How tall are you?
196.
Oh, I should have noticed you. You have a brother?
I do.
You are taller than your brother.
I do.
You are. Why was it a safe bet on my part? That's a phenomenon that is statistical phenomenon known as regression to the mean. The explanation is quite simple. Let me turn on the light for just a moment. I need to get a pen to demonstrate it to you. Let's get a few pens just in case they are not working. So height of people usually comes from a normal distribution. Suppose, everyone of us, because of the genetic predisposition, genetic constitution has, the family height. So also you have that. Suppose it's, I don't know what it is. Let's say 180 is the average height in your family. Suppose you may come from a family of tall people. And then, most men in your family will be, they can be shorter or longer, but if you look at the average, it's going to be around here. Now I observe a very tall individual, 196. Wow. That's a lot. My first thing is, no matter what his family average is, probably he is an outlier. He is somewhere here. Right? Somewhere here. So 196 is at this end. Because I selected him visually, I found a very tall person, so good chance that he's on the extreme. Because the average in Poland is what? I don't know what it is. I'm 176. When I look at students now, I seem to be short. I was definitely average when I grew up. In any case, now, my betting, I bet your brother is shorter. Look at that. We take another individual, another man from his family, and then here's the probability of being taller, and here's the probability of being shorter. Which is bigger? Right? It's a safe bet. Whenever you are selecting something based on an extreme result, then you always have that thing. And it's called statistical regression to the mean. Regression to the mean. So next time you pick somebody from the population, it's going to be closer to the mean than the extreme measure. Okay?
But that's the idea.
That's a very strong phenomenon working in statistics, and it works, for example, with children. We often, as humans, misunderstand it. Suppose a child behaves very, very nicely. You know, we go out, the child is like very, very nicely sitting and eating and not doing anything bad. We say, Johnny, good job, you've been so nice today. And then, next day we notice, boy, John is such a nasty little brat. And we think, well, probably because we praised him, that's resulted in bad behavior. The other extreme is when Johnny misbehaves, you know, starts stamping, throwing things in a restaurant, screaming, etc. We punish him. Next day he's so nice. We think punishment worked. While, actually, if this is the average behavior of Johnny, we observe an extreme behavior. No matter what we do, next time he's going to be closer to his normal behavior than the previous day. Praising a child, of course for good reasons, don't praise your child for nothing, but praising your child actually works much better, much stronger than punishing. But very often we misunderstand it and we think, well, I praised him and now he's so bad. Yes? And he's so bad just because the very bad behavior, the very good behavior was just an extreme thing for him. But that's the regression to the mean. So here, in this context, statistical regression is, we had a bad day. That's why we didn't have a solution. Next morning we wake up, wow. Comes like this, right? Because our average ability to find a solution is somewhere, you know, better than that. Okay, so here are different ways, and he tested, these are the different things about the different theories of why it happens. So what he did is he wanted to test two things. He wanted to test forgetting and timing. Forgetting by prompting the people who got a problem to solve. He gave them riddles. You know, riddles like, riddles like this. It's long, red, and stops often. A bus, right? Or something like this. He gave professors riddles like this. There were, I forgot how many, five or so subjects, a handful of subjects. He gave them riddles, and then he asked them to record what they were doing. The idea was that he hoped to find evidence that they were actually thinking about the problem. The second thing he did was priming. He gave them the solutions or hints to the solution in a way that they didn't even realize they were getting it. For example, the solution to a riddle was pumpkin. He would go into the toilet cabin and draw a pumpkin on the board and put something silly. Johnny, you are a pumpkin. Something very silly, but definitely pumpkin there. And of course every professor, male professor, they were all males I think, had to visit the restroom. There's no way you can go the whole day without visiting a restroom. So they saw it. He would do another thing. He would have a riddle that had the solution umbrella. And he would ask a friend to call a professor, who was the subject, and ask, well, Dr. Simon, I visited you yesterday, and I have left my umbrella somewhere. Is it perhaps in your office? No umbrella, sorry. That's it, that's the end of the conversation. And then what he noticed is that, that these are the details, you know, you have to describe all the components of an experiment very precisely. So there were 14 different riddles, chalkboards, Polaroid camera was to take pictures of the chalkboards. This is 30 something years ago. Four professors, so there were very few subjects. And then he gave them 5 days for solving the riddle, etc., etc. I told you most of the things. And then he did also ask them
between 12 and 30 days later to recall how they solved it, whether they remembered anything. Priming was graffiti, telephone calls, or posts on the psychology department's bulletin board. I told you about the bulletin board. It was like comparable to today's Facebook or LinkedIn. Hypothesis was, of course, they had to blind them, not to tell them what it was about. But the real hypothesis was that they would underestimate the amount of time devoted to the puzzles, but also priming, they would not even notice that they were primed, and they would solve the problems faster. This is the forgetting. The result was not statistically significant, with four subjects, not surprising really. But the priming, which is why I'm telling you about this, was statistically significantly improving the problem-solving skill. 64% of primed puzzles were solved, only 25% on unprimed were solved. And the interesting thing is that they didn't even realize they were primed. So they forgot about it completely. Only later, when he told them, do you remember there was a pumpkin on the board? Said, oh yeah, I remember, there was a pumpkin on the board. But they didn't realize there was a pumpkin when they came up with the solution. So they came up with the solution, it was a pumpkin. They saw the pumpkin, they had seen the pumpkin, but they didn't realize it was connected to the puzzle they were solving. So I'm not getting into the details, that's why I'm rushing through it. Fleming, I mentioned, you've seen this slide already. Remember, he was primed, essentially, he saw that dirty dishes and fungi and bacteria, that kind of helped him with finding the solution. Flying a kite. That priming happened in the past. When he was a child, he was flying a kite with his father. Priming can occur also in the past, not necessarily when you, while you are thinking about a problem. It can be something that, some experience that you had in the past. Here, remember, he was essentially the observation he made in the local government in Milwaukee helped him to find a solution. Here was another one, the ecotherapy guy. You've seen the slide also. You have to be prepared to see things, to notice and then expose yourself to prime. This is my oldest son when he was really very little, but I wanted to show you another evidence that priming is so important in practice. Let me show that. Let's see, creativity. When he was little, let me see if I can use this to advance. When he was a little boy, he was still, I don't know, four or five, he wrote a book. The story of the ship that blew up in a storm. This is the actual scan of his book. I have his permission to use it in this class. And then the book, you see the color on the outside, black and white inside. And there is a story. If you read it, you will find it quite creative. A story of people who were on the ship, and there was a thunderstorm. Then the ship caught fire and started burning, exploded, and blew up. Synonym of exploded. And people, but the people jumped into boats and they reached an island and they were all saved. This is the backside of the book. Would you consider this to be creative for a boy of, I forgot, five or six? He was definitely before the school.
I would say most people would find it quite creative, quite well, for a child, that's interesting. Including the idea that the cover is in color, the middle is black and white. What was this influenced by? This was a book that we read. We've watched a movie, Disney movie, about the Little Mermaid. I've seen that movie many times. We often watched it together. I knew the dialogues by heart, of course. So did he. Prove that it was his book. It's written here. And you see very similar story with a boat, people dancing, having a party, then a thunderstorm, the ship actually blows up in the movie, a little mermaid rescues that guy. He changed the story a little bit, right? But he changed the story, but there is no doubt that he was influenced by that story very strongly. He was too young to understand the concept of plagiarism. He was just doing something that he wanted. He wanted to show what he was, how smart he was. He was primed, essentially. He's seen it in the movie many times, in the book. I think that very often our behavior is based on the things that we've done in the past, that we've seen in the past. We are plagiarizing. I'm talking about myself, but I suspect it also, when you think about your behavior, creative behavior, you will also find things that you have, that you are essentially plagiarizing, not really. You are not violating copyright laws, but you are essentially doing things that you've seen somewhere in your youth in the past. That's him years later. Grunbaum is to me another example of a very creative person. In the context of creativity, I may have mentioned to you Freud, his work on Freud. I don't know how much I told you about Freud, but the problem with Freud is that many scientists think or thought that Freud's psychoanalysis is not science. It's completely not science. It's more like a religion, similar to Marxism. Marxism is also like almost like a religion. Why? What do they mean by that? Science has theories and hypotheses that are falsifiable. So if I say that if I press that table strong enough, the table will change the shape and then exert the force back or something. We can actually check it. We can falsify it. If my theory is wrong, we can make predictions that when the predictions don't happen, the theory was wrong. So it's science. In the case of Marxism, it's not falsifiable because Marxism talks about class struggle. It explains history as a class struggle. So you talk about the revolution in ancient Egypt, of course, class struggle. First World War, of course, class struggle. Second World War, sure, class struggle. War in Ukraine, class struggle, always. You cannot falsify it because you can explain everything with a theory. The same with Freud. Examples of theories that don't sound falsifiable are the theory, for example, of... he has a theory that schizophrenia, which is a terrible mental disease, is... caused by repressed homosexuality. So if he is schizophrenic, then he is repressing homosexuality. And he says, no, I've had girlfriends all my life, I'm married. You are repressing it. You see the difficulty, right? No matter how much he denies that, I can keep claiming, no, you are repressing homosexuality. So how can you falsify the theory? It seems to be completely unbiteable. Another theory of Freud that is similar in nature is the theory of dreams. Whenever you have a dream, and Freud was a wonderful writer. When you read Freud, it's just such a pleasure of writing. So convincing. When you read Freud, you think, wow, so nice. The theory is that every dream that we have
has an unconscious wish. So, for example, I feel like drinking something. Maybe I haven't drank enough. If I go to sleep, I may have a dream in which I drink a lot of water. Yeah? And that theory, that dream, essentially fulfills my unconscious wish. You think about something sweet. You'd like to eat something sweet. You go to sleep. In the sleep, you have a dream where you eat a big cake, big sweet cake, and that fulfills your wish. The problem with that theory is that you may have an unpleasant wish. Anybody here who had an unpleasant wish, like you came to an exam unprepared? Nobody had dreams like this. Well, I had dreams like that, not often, but sometimes. I would dream as a student that I come to exam unprepared. When I became a professor, I started having dreams once in a while that I come to lecture unprepared, and people are looking at me and laughing that I cannot perform. Nobody had dreams like this? I bet that most of you had unpleasant dreams like this. So unpleasant dreams, what do they tell us? When you think about it logically, then, if unconscious wishes are fulfilled by my dream, maybe my unconscious wish was to suffer. Who has dreams about, who wants to suffer? Masochists. So that's one explanation, of course. You are a masochist. What is other explanation? I cannot think of any, but Freud had an explanation. A young attorney in Vienna came to him and said, Dr. Freud, he was a patient of Freud, I had a terrible dream. I lost all my cases. What was Freud's diagnosis? That young attorney was a very smart fellow. He argued with me during the sessions very often. That dream has fulfilled his desire to prove me wrong. And you see that you can explain every dream, and you cannot falsify anything, essentially. That was the position of many philosophers of science. Philosophers of science study how science is being done, methodology and other things. You cannot be a scientist without getting a little bit of philosophy of science. Grünbaum was a philosopher of science, and I credit a lot of things in my life to his teaching. He was a great teacher. In any case, the paper I have a few slides about is that how do you start criticizing Freud if it's something unfalsifiable? Well, Grünbaum actually, great thinker, he did it in a very smart way, a very creative way of doing this. He said, no, it's not true that you cannot falsify Freud. His theories are falsifiable. For example, this guy who is schizophrenic, sure, maybe he is repressive, maybe he's not repressive. But I can falsify his theory in the following way. There is a guy on the corner of Wiejska and Pogodna, standing in the middle of the street and shouting to bypassers, people, look at me, I'm homosexual, look. He is not repressive, is it? Is he? He is openly homosexual and not repressing it at all. If he is at the same time as schizophrenic, then the theory is false, right? He's not repressing. So you can actually falsify the theory. In case of theory of dreams, it's harder, but Grünbaum did it in a very interesting way. There's a paper that I heard him present first. I was in the audience. Then I asked him for a copy. It was a great way of actually, very creative way of criticizing it. This was a causal graph for what Freud theory is. There is a wish, and then you have a dream caused by that wish. That dream fulfills your wish, and there's also manifest content of the dream. Manifest content of the young attorney is that he lost all his cases, right? But the actual wish was to prove Freud wrong, and it was fulfilled. Freud was wrong. That was the explanation that Freud had. There was another case that he describes in the paper, Irma. Irma was he always had those funny names, not true names of the patients. Irma's dream, a famous thing in Freud. A woman comes to him, she's been treated by Freud many years, and she many times said that she hated her mother-in-law. She just couldn't stand her, couldn't even be in the same room with her. And one day she comes to Freud and says, "Dr. Freud, I had this terrible dream. I woke up completely wet, sweated, because I dreamt that I arranged vacation with my husband and his mother. And I arranged the hotel rooms to be next to each other. That was a terrible dream." His explanation was also that she was a smart patient who wanted him to be wrong. That was his explanation. So then Grünbaum has actually looks at many aspects of that that thing, but the funniest thing that he was explaining, the way he explained it, is that Freud apparently classifies all the people in the world into three groups. The healthy people. Healthy people are those who are thirsty and they are dreaming about drinking. They want to have something sweet, they are dreaming about having a sweet cake. The second group are masochists. People who really enjoy suffering, and because they really want to suffer, the dreams, the suffering dreams, are essentially fulfilling that wish. Apparently that happens a lot with everybody. There are soldiers who are having those terrible dreams, nightmares, over and over, of the battle where they lose their hand or leg. They are reliving it. So the second class are masochists. And the third class is people who do not wish Freud and his theories too well. They are essentially, they want him, his theories, to be wrong. And funny, because Grünbaum says, "As far as I know," writes in the paper, and then he, it wasn't in the paper, but his wife was in the audience, so he said, "And Thelma," everybody knew him because he was in the philosophy department, "and Thelma can testify that I'm not a masochist, and I had those dreams, those bad dreams, well before I have ever heard about Freud." So that is essentially the way he presented it. And it was also, it's really a pleasure to read that paper, because Freud, as a great writer, he writes about Irma, "Wasn't her dream the most sharp contradiction of my theory?" Right? Of course it wasn't a contradiction, Grünbaum writes, because maybe she secretly, unconsciously loved her mother-in-law. Right? Maybe she just didn't even realize it, that she loved her. So it was funny. If you want to read that paper, I'll be happy to make it available to you. It's just a pleasure to read it. I'm going very fast because I found it a very, very creative piece of work. Sometimes we have to be creative as scientists in those difficult situations when things seem to be very, very difficult. Of course, it's easy to say Freud's work is just like a religion. You cannot falsify it. Grünbaum did it in another way. He said, surely you can falsify them, you can test them, but unfortunately for Freud, all of his theories are wrong. And he was just picking one after another, showing problems with those theories. Here's the thing that he was also a good writer. "As we saw, the wish contravening manifest content of these distressing dreams does not graphically portray Freud to be wrong, because she could, of course, dreamt Freud being wrong. So it wasn't the sharpest. He said, I believe him to be wrong, but even if I had to, if I had ulterior motives for wishing him to be wrong, there's no evidence that this putative wish actually endangered my counter-wish dreams." So very interesting. And then other, of course, reason. So now, summary of that, of this whole thing on creativity.
I think the strongest thing, you've seen the phases of the process. That's very good to know. Don't leave the first phase too early. Think about the problem carefully, about the tools that you have, what you need, etc. About the constraints, the assumptions that you put on yourself. They're very important. Try to make that incubation as long as you can. Allow time. Verification, which is the cold looking at your solution, should happen at the end. Don't judge yourself too early. These are important things. The second important thing in this whole lecture was, I think, the blocks to creativity. Work on them systematically. If you are in a toxic environment, leave it. Just leave it. Or do your creative thinking somewhere else, outside of that environment. Be aware of the cultural blocks, of your biases, etc. Try to be playful. Use your artistic skills. But from Kaplan, I think the most important thing is the priming. Priming helps a lot. Doing many things, being curious, that's very, very important. Of course, I did many stupid things in my life. Probably every one of us did some stupid things. But one of the most stupid things was in high school, we were talking with friends, and I said, well, chemistry doesn't look like a very important thing because I'm going to be an engineer, not a chemist, so not important. Or history. History, you know, who cares, right? But then later, in my life, I realized that whatever I learned in chemistry or in history, in biology, turned out to be useful. You never know when things will become useful. The capacity of our brain is practically infinite. Practically, theoretically, it is finite, but it's in practice infinite. So there is always room for more. Don't be afraid of learning things, especially outside of your area, because you never know how things from the outside of your area will become useful in your area of research. And what you saw of my son, that was just a funny example, I think, demonstrates that children don't have the idea of any idea of plagiarism or copying things, but they are doing this. And I think we are doing that as adults too. Definitely a lot of my behavior is influenced by that. Wason and Johnson learned. That's an interesting psychological experiment. In psychology, there are several fundamental experiments, but not as many as there are papers. But some of the experiments are fundamental at telling us something about ourselves. Here is one of those experiments. I think it's 1960s or so, by two guys, Wason and Johnson Laird. Here is the task for the subjects. Subjects are just, you know, like you, psychology students. There are cards on the table. One side of the card has a letter. The other side has a number. And your task is to test the following rule. If a card has a vowel on one side, then it has an even number on the other side. You understand the idea, right? So if you, for example, E, if it has an odd number on the other side, then the rule is broken. It's not valid. Your task is to verify that for every card that it fulfills the rule. If it has even number, then everything is fine. Yes? So the question now is, which of the cards should you turn over to check? Which cards? Clearly E, because if E has odd number, then the rule is not valid. Yes? That's the easiest thing. Most subjects turn over this card. What other card do you need to turn over?
Seven,
yes. Only 30% of the subjects point out that seven has to be turned over. Of course, you are not a very, you are a special audience. You had all mathematics, you loved it probably, you like logic, so you see that K doesn't matter because it's not even mentioned in the rule. This, it doesn't matter if it's an
consonant or vowel on the other side. Even if it's a vowel, then it's fulfilled. Yes? So we don't need to turn over this and this. We need to turn over this one. Just in case there's a vowel on the other end, 7 will violate the rule. So it's a difficult problem. As I said, most people turn over this card correctly. Around 30% of the people turn over this card. Here is an isomorph of this problem. An isomorph, so identical problem, just a different domain, just different phrasing. You have to test the following rule. Every time I go to New York City, I travel by train. Isn't this easier to solve? You have to open this one, of course. Also this. So much easier. This isomorph is solved close to correct by majority of the subjects. I forgot the exact number, but definitely 70-80% of the people open this card also. There's another isomorph that doesn't work well in Poland, but in the Netherlands where I lived, if you didn't close the envelope, like left it open, you could put a stamp for less money. The idea is to stimulate sending postcards, Christmas cards, etc. And now, as a post office employee, which of the envelopes you have to turn over to make sure that they have the correct postage? Assuming that they do have 60 or 40 here behind. This is the one. Because here, it doesn't matter whether it's 60 or 40, but here it does matter. It's closed. It has to be 60. What is the conclusion of this? The conclusion of this experiment is that I don't have that conclusion. The conclusion that I find most interesting is that there are no domain-independent rules of logic in our thinking. So it's not the case that we will solve every isomorph of the same problem within the same amount of time. Some of the isomorphs, they are identical in the structure. Some of them are harder than the others. In human thinking, domain is always very important because we don't learn the world by rules of logic, but we learn by the situation, whatever is in the domain. There are no independent rules of logic in human thinking. What is the conclusion from that I draw? Whenever you are trying to solve a problem in the abstract, a mathematical problem, rather than thinking about A, B, C, D, try to think about a concrete thing. Okay, if it's a table, a chair, and a car, how does this work? Solve it in a domain where you know, that is very familiar to you, and then generalize it to A, B, C, D. Very important advice that will make you find solutions faster, quicker. A small problem, instead of solving the problem from 0 to infinity, solve it for a small set, 3, 4, 2, 3, 4. Solve it in a concrete and in a small addition. Then that will help you a lot. The next slide is showing us Walt Disney, that's a guy. Walt Disney was a very interesting fellow. He invented the idea of entertainment parks, but also got into the movies, the cartoon movies. If you have seen any of the old Disney movies, like 1930s, they are still there. You can find them probably on YouTube. You notice that Mickey Mouse is actually breathing. You see the Mickey Mouse actually move the chest. There are some cartoons that are not that complicated, like Yogi Bear probably doesn't do that. They just move their mouth, you know, like that. But in Disney movies, they were behaving much nicer. You see them breathing and talking. To do that, you need a lot of drawings. The drawings took a lot of time. There were many artists in the room making those drawings. What he did is he invented something that is known now as a storyboard. he essentially had a few of those drawings, and you know, had the whole movie was shown like this. And then the another idea is that they were hanging the drawings that they made on the wall all around you in the studio. And that was very nice, because people knew where they were, and that helped them a lot. The idea that in psychology that explains why this was a good idea is the knowledge of the architecture of our brain at the symbolic level, because, you know, at some level our brain is just a connection of neurons, but well, what can we say about that? Not much. But at the symbolic level, we look at the brain as having memory, long-term memory. It's called LTM, long-term memory. That's the memory that stays for a long time. When you know something, it stays there. Then there is short-term memory. Short-term memory has a very small capacity. It's 5 plus minus 2. Some people say 7 plus minus 2. And it's something transient. You can keep things in short-term memory by repeating it. If I tell you, for example, a phone number, 721-235-321, you can remember it by repeating it yourself for a little bit, but most of us will forget it if we don't repeat it. It takes about 2 seconds, I think, to bring something from short-term memory to long-term memory. And that's a limitation of our thinking. Short-term memory is essentially telling us that we can focus only on a small number of things, 5 things at the same time. Things, so it's either letters or digits or sentences or books or images. They kind of are countries, you know, they compose into chunks of information. But anyway, the short-term memory, just 5 plus minus 2 of these. And that is a limitation on our thinking. If you want to extend your thinking, if you want to make it better, one very simple trick is known as working memory. That's what psychologists call it, working memory. Working memory is short-term memory in here, plus everything that I see. So I can have on my board many things, and since I have them in front of me, I have quick access. I know where they are. If you ask me a question about them, I will tell you right away. Plus my short-term memory. If you want to extend your capacity, do something that he did. I don't have a picture of that. Have a big computer screen, 19 inches or 21 inches, and have 2 of these next to each other. Then your working memory is much bigger. It's the most important element of a computer, I think, if you use computer for just daily things, not for heavy calculations, the screen, because that extends your short-term memory. Very important idea. Try it, and you will see that that it will increase your capacity. Another thing that I did a lot is to extend my short-term memory is to have a calendar on my wall in my office, where I write things that I have to do. Like I divide it into the 4 months of the semester and write the weekends, the dates, and then travel and exams and important things. I have it right in front of me. And that's another trick that I definitely recommend you. There are no context-free rules in human reasoning. That's Wason and Johnson learned. So do all kinds of wild things. Don't be afraid of doing them. Just indulge yourself in things. Go to a theater. Go to see a movie. Read a good book. Talk to people in your outside of your domain. Collect things because you never know when they are going to be useful, important. The best way to have a good idea is to have a lot of ideas. That's an idea that I heard in fishing. I read it in a book about fishing. I like fishing. It's one of the things that I do to completely switch off to kind of get rest. If you want to catch a big pike, you have to catch many pikes. One of them is going to be big. If you want to have a great idea, you need to have a lot of ideas. Then some of them are going to be great. Don't be afraid of failures. Many brilliant people have failed before you. Each of these people were that's in Polish, unfortunately. Yes, that's in Polish. If you have never fallen, it means that you've never tried anything new. All of these people had problems. Walt Disney, they threw him out of a newspaper because he didn't have enough imagination, they wrote. Can you imagine that? Steve Jobs, you all know probably this, the story of Steve Jobs. Albert Einstein was also considered to be not a very smart boy. Grunbaum himself, he told the story that when he was a young man, he was going to religious education, and the rabbi that was teaching them, the children, told him that you are so stupid that nothing will ever come out of you. I think that's more or less what he said. So the rabbi who was teaching him considered him completely stupid. But he was one of the smartest people I've had the pleasure to know personally. So don't be afraid of any failure. Bad grades are not always equaling the possibility of learning. Many examples that you can find that didn't have best grades. I'm out of time, so that's why I was going a little faster. Not funding. What I want to do is I'm going to talk about time management and stress management. I think this is what we should talk about. If I find some time, maybe a little bit about job search. Not necessarily important for you at the moment, but at some point you will be applying for jobs, so that may be also useful. We are approaching the end of the semester. This is the last meeting in April, and I think we have two meetings in May. That's what we have. So two more things, coping with stress, time management, and ethics. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for, I think, 1 minute longer. I haven't checked the presence. I'm sorry. While you are going away, I will check the presence. Once you have told me you are there, you can go. And sorry for extending. Ms. Bolinska, Wyliński, Falkowski, Ige, yes, Jaroszewicz, Kieszmerski, Kowalczyk, yes. Leszczyński, Magnuson. There, Malinowska, Matowicki, Moczydłowska, Muśko, Ostaszewska, Pantoł, pani Sokowicz, Siedlecki, Sokołowska, Sokół, Sumorek, Szakowski, Tomaszewski, Użyński. Super. Mam dla wszystkich, Państwo możecie zobaczyć. Dziękuję Państwu i do zobaczenia za tydzień.
Tak? O, naprawdę?
Widzenia.
Do widzenia.
Coś tam robicie?
Do widzenia, wziąłem do wieczoru.
Do widzenia.